diving in. I think the music that I've used today has been pretty sedate. But, hey, we're getting there.
It's across the board, but that was the best song you've played by far.
What, like in the last month? All right, guys. Troy Harmon, Jared McKenzie, and DJ Barker. Talking to you about financial questions. We'll be willing to answer any and all of your financial, economic, financial planning. Give it to us, and we'll give it a try. So in order to contact us, you can call our question hotline at 1-855-429-9166. Our next question actually did come to us from the question hotline. But you can also reach us directly, 770-429-9166. You can speak to a real person if you call that number. If they don't pick up, you can leave a message there and they'll call you back. Or you can email us at drgene@hensler.com. That's spelled H-E-N-S-S-L-E-R.com. If you want information on our company, Hensler Financial, you can go to hensler.com as well. Basically, if you type in Hensler, you should be able to find us. So we have a question, as I teased before the break, about the investment side of Equifax. You know, the breach.
Imagine
has,
it's pretty cheap.
Has it taken a hit?
Well, it's down 35 to 37%. Depends on what time of the day you look at it.
I'm going in.
You know, we got a company that's about $10.5 billion in market cap at this point, but it lost a third, more than a third of its full market cap. So we're down from 15.8, I think it was at the top just a couple of months ago.
So is the damage done? I mean, in all seriousness, how much of a buying opportunity might this be?
Okay, so I talked about this last week, and I really do believe that the stock's value is probably higher than this, but I'm not sure. And the problem is we still keep seeing this thing unfold. It's like a slow-moving train wreck. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the breach, which would be bad enough, but then you get management that says, we'll help you out, we'll freeze your credit, or we'll let you check your credit. But in order for you to check your credit, you're going to have to sign off that you won't sue us. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Something you caused, and now you're going to help us and try to keep yourself intact at the same time. That's a little tacky. And then they tell us that, oh, yeah, we knew this months ago. Another tacky move. We had a patch that could have fixed it but didn't. I mean, there's all kind of things that just keep coming out. They would let you freeze your credit, gave you a password, but it turns out that it was just based on the time and the day that you were requesting the freeze. There's just too many things that have gone on. What I really believe, and I said this last week, I believe the CEO is going to wind up losing his position.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Wouldn't because I imagine that's what will come out of this, right? He's going to get ousted to one degree or another, opportunity to retire.
Sure. Maybe.
Would that maybe not be seen as a good thing by the market, and that there's a change in leadership that clearly has not been able to manage?
He hasn't been fired yet. So what are they waiting on? My take on it is
the worst.
They're waiting on to see is there any more fallout.
Yeah.
Once they have all
how
the,
worse will it get? When,
once they have everything lumped together, and it probably won't be long, they will they'll make an announcement that he's gone. They're going to hang that on him and let him go away. The issue is me and you and Jarrett and everybody else listening to us are not really customers of Equifax. We're customers of the retailer or the card company that reports our information. It's kind of a centralized location for them to know information on us to determine what risk we are for them to extend credit. So in the end, we can't ask to be clients of theirs or ask not to be clients of theirs. You can't quit them. So ultimately, I think Equifax survives. Equifax gets sued. Equifax loses their CEO. But ultimately, I believe that you will see the price go higher. Even right now, when we look in the market, the price has fallen, as I said, 37%. As of the recording of this show, the average opinion of all analysts who put their opinion in Bloomberg, our news terminal for financial news, they say that the stock is about 27% undervalued right now. Do I say it's time to buy? Not yet. I would say you're not going to buy it at the bottom if you do it the way that I would do it. And by the way, we don't trade securities. We're not in that business. We're investors. We look for companies that have solid earnings, earnings growth, profitability, and a valuable price, meaning an attractive sure. price at the, you know, relative to those fundamentals that I just talked about. And that's where we invest. But at the moment, Equifax looks cheaper than I think it will in a year. But I don't think all the news is out, and I don't think the final lawsuit has been filed. I yeah. really think it's probably early to buy. But I, you know, if you're into taking a risk like that with some fun money, maybe. I don't well, think you ought to
Vegas
put it in your retirement account. No.
Right.
Right.
Does it or the other two bureaus, do you know if it meets our criteria?
They do,
Have
yeah.
you looked at it?
Yes,
yeah.
all three of them, including Fair Isaac. I mean, there's a lot of those type companies. And if you think about 2007 and 8, mm-hmm. the government was trying to hitch the whole downturn on who? Moody's, S&P, the rating agencies. They had done us wrong. They yeah. Allowed for these horrible mortgages to be put in with other mortgages that weren't so bad, but all of them failed. It cost investors a lot of money. Sure, that did happen. It wasn't all their fault. The fact that some of those mortgages were even being backed by the likes of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, in my opinion, was suspect, which who allows that? It's the regulator.
Yeah.
But in the end, those companies survived, didn't get sued. It was a bit of a different situation. You know, there wasn't a breach of somebody else's information. But in the end, it looked as bleak for them at that time mm-hmm. as it does for Equifax at the moment.
These are all privately owned, right? The bureaus, or is that a and even the Moody's and
Moody's and S&P are both publicly traded,
right?
These
are not government entities
that are not
at substantial risk of failure if something like this takes
private
place.
Private held but publicly traded companies,
right.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So my ultimate opinion is, yeah, they've been beaten down probably beyond where they should, but the market overshoots a lot, especially if the news is horrible mm-hmm. Or if the news is really good. It'll buy up. Think about it. That's what the tech bubble was made of, right?
Yeah.
Everybody thought that they'd never lose a dime buying a company as long as it had .com at the back of it.
Right.
It's just one of those anomalies that happens quite a bit.
Well, can I ask you this? Might TransUnion and Experian stand to gain from this more than a rebound in Equifax?
No, I don't think so.
So you think there's more opportunity in Equifax than if you were to try and say, okay, yeah. well, if they're going to fare better because of this breach on yeah. one of their competitors, essentially.
Yeah, if you look at the price of any one of these companies, it still looks, you know, they all still look relatively expensive like the rest of the market does. But you look at Equifax, and it's clearly been beaten down over the last 2 weeks.
Sure.
But again, you know, this is not an investment. This is more of a speculation. This is something that somebody might go out and take a flyer on. Yeah, this is not to put in your retirement account without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Ed Kelly, that is your answer. We appreciate you you submitting it. Guys, we got a question here, and I'm going to let this one, since it is an audio question, I'm going to let it run. We'll answer it to the best of our ability in the next few minutes if we have to. Take a break in the middle of it. We'll come back and talk about it. But here you go, Adrian. Debt to income ratio. Here you go.
Hello, my name is Adrian. I'm calling from Austell. I wondered if you could tell me what's considered a good debt to income ratio. I still have a little bit of unsecured debt from a divorce a few years ago, and I'm going to be in the market to buy a house in the next couple of years. I just want to make sure that I'm going to be a good candidate for a mortgage. Thank you.
It's probably a good idea to think about, you know, you got a purchase, big purchase coming up. You know you're going to use some debt.
Sure.
So
just planning. Love to
yeah,
see that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thinking ahead.
Guys.
That's right. Because it may take some manipulation. I mean, that's a great question, especially if you're considering a mortgage, because generally a bank's not going to want to see anything north of, say, 40 to 45% debt to income. And so, you know, if you're planning something like that, you may want to try and move some things around so that you do eliminate some of that debt if you can, because it's going to be a lot more difficult in the underwriting process with a bank if that debt to income ratio is more substantial. Now, as far as when, let's say you get the mortgage and you're looking at debt-to-income ratio then, I mean, generally speaking, you want it to be lower. The banks obviously want to loan you money because that's partly how they make their money, and so they're going to give you a little more flexibility. But generally speaking, we'd want to see it no more than, say, 25 or 30% is the general rule. So we'll get a little more information on that whenever we come back, but maybe this would be a good point to take a break and then circle back around with some more aspects of her question.
Hey, before you do that, though, again, you can reach us at 1-855-429-9166. That's our recorded question hotline. You can call us directly, 770-429-9166, or you can email us at drgene@hensler.com.
That's right.
Go on our website and check that out. You can also reach us through multiple venues and social media, including LinkedIn.
Give us a call.
Yeah, Facebook. We got all kinds of
cheapest free advice you can get.
Cheapest free. Let me think about that while you talk about Adrian from Austell.
Well, exactly. Adrian, you pose a great question, and I know there's a lot of folks out there that probably have the same one. And, you know, that's what I mean, honestly. You know, you took the time to submit this question to us. And so, you know, it's good to be able to talk about these things and remind people that, you know, there are certain considerations that you want to make. And in your case, one that you should probably make early on, because, again, it very well may take some manipulation and movement of things to the extent that you can. Because, again, you know, if you are after the mortgage, then you're going to want to, or the bank, I should say, is going to want to see a debt-to-income ratio really no more than the 40 to 45% level, like I said. But just generally speaking, when you're kind of planning for budgeting purposes and your month-to-month cash flow, you want to try to keep it a little bit lower. You know, when you're talking about a monthly house payment and what part of your income goes towards that, you know, certainly that's going to be a much more appropriate level than what the bank may be accepting of. So, you know, to answer your question, 40 to 45% from a bank standpoint, 25 to 30 maybe, just from a general perspective, keeping it in and around those levels should put you in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I mean, and if you wanted to calculate this at home, you add up your recurring monthly debt and you divide it by your gross monthly income.
There you go.
Easy enough.
Easy enough to try to, hopefully that'll help.
Yeah.
All right, 40 to 45%. Sounds good.
What else we got? Anybody from Paulding today?
No, we do have Adam from Kennesaw, who says, in the last 3 months, one of my holdings seems to be on a fast decline, Apogee Enterprises. I'm coming up on a year holding this. Do I cut my losses and sell? Apogee's, it doesn't look like a terrible company. The one thing that I do notice is they design and develop glass solutions for enclosing buildings. You would figure in the aftermath of two major hurricanes in the U.S., they might get a little bit of a pop in business, but reality is their long-term is probably a bit more muted. Glass companies in general have moved offshore, and it makes it difficult for them. I think it's going to make it difficult longer term for them to compete.
Sure.
So, you know, ultimately that's what I'm going to say. Probably I would go ahead and sell. Now, Adam says, should I sell now? It's almost a year. Should I sell now or do I wait?
Yeah.
Now, this might be, and he doesn't really give us exact detail, but there's a difference, right, Jarrett?
Absolutely. And, I mean, look, this is something, let me just say, first of all, that this is an advantage that you gain by owning individual securities, kind of going back to something we touched on one of the previous shows, in that, you know, when you use ETFs, which I know a lot of people think and are correct in thinking that, you know, this is a lot cheaper, more cost-effective to own it that way. You get the advantage of diversification, and that's true. There's some points to be made about that as well. But this is a big thing that you lose issues when you invest in that manner, because in owning one individual entity like this and being able to step away from it, if you do want to cut your losses and sell, the advantage you would gain then is your ability to tax or harvest any losses, which we refer to as tax loss harvesting. And, you know, particularly here at the end of the year, I'm sure that throughout the course of the first half of this year, since the market's been on a pretty good run this year, there's going to be some gains that maybe you've taken. And even if you haven't, if you take some losses and recognize these losses, then that's going to give you an ability throughout the course of the remainder of the year to then look to say, okay, well, I've got some losses that can be offset by some gains. And so then maybe you can trim one of these positions that have done well for you, recognize some of those gains, and avoid having to pay much tax, if any, because now you've got some losses in the sale of this company to then offset whatever gains you might incur as a result of that trim.
You can actually use those losses in previous years as well as future years as well, right?
Yeah, you can. So, matter of fact, DJ and I had a scenario once where, you know, we took some losses for a client, and the client was none too happy because she, in this case, did not have any gains for that year and didn't feel that she needed any losses to be recognized for her. But it just so happened in the following year, which I think was 2015, which was it was 2016, I guess it was last year. It's a really pretty good year. And we had done some cross-the-board stuff and recognized some gains for her that she didn't end up being impacted much at all by, because she had this carry-forward that she was able to use. And so, yes, you can continue to.
Could be, so you saw the benefit at that point. Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. She was confused at first, but saw that benefit.
Right.
And the difference here is if Adam sold this stock, Apogee, before the 1 year, he gets a different rate, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you got short-term gains, you got long-term gains. Anything previous or prior to 12 months would be short term, and that's obviously taxed at a different rate than the long term, which is anything beyond 12 months. And so the short term gains are taxed at ordinary income rates, where the long term is taxed at long term capital gains rates, which for most of us is 15%, unless you're in the highest bracket, in which case it would be 20%. But you know, in either of those cases, your ordinary income tax rate is probably going to be higher. And so, you know, first your short term and your long term losses or gains are netted, and then they can offset your income to an extent. As far as losses go, they can only offset, long-term losses can only offset up to $3,000 of ordinary income, where if you take short-term losses, because those are taxed at ordinary income rates, then you can actually offset up to more than that potentially, as long as those losses are matching up as far as the short-term or long-term in those cases. And so, yes, it does matter. And, you know, I think that the short-term gains are at least as advantageous as the long-term ones. And so, you know, I would say if it's been owned for less than 12 months, I'd probably go ahead and get rid of it. If you're thinking about it anyways.
If it's a company that you have no conviction over, sure, I would sell it.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right.
Well, and that kind of leads us into one related and final thing here with mutual funds, because this was a question that came up recently as we do prepare for this end of the year push to harvest any losses where it's worthwhile to do so. And so as far as mutual funds go, you know, we had a client recently asking about the redemptions that are made at the end of the year and this payout that happens. And while that certainly does not decrease the value of your account or your portfolio because it's being paid out in cash, and, you know, it looks like there's a loss in the security,
sure,
but in fact, the value of the account remains the same or may even be a little bit higher.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things DJ and I were talking about before the show, is that's actually advantageous in this very same way, in that, you know, and we've had the case with our equity fund before, where when we pay out at the end of the year,
sure,
it does look like it has caused decline
the
value.
Exactly. Prices do decline.
So there's a loss when a fund
pays out a dividend. Right.
Right. Exactly. And it looks like there's a loss, and we can now harvest some of that potentially for, you know, if there is an opportunity to do that, it may create the same advantage.
Right. There's a couple of things you need to be mindful of. If you've got a fund that's on automatic
dividend
reinvestment,
mm-hmm,
if you buy it, then you can't sell it for,
yep,
31 days. So you got to be careful. There's some tax rules you got to work around.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, so if the price did fall and you bought more and then you wanted to sell before the year end, usually you're kind of in a pickle. You'd have
right
to push it into the following year. But,
mm-hmm,
you know, if the dividend is paid out, you get cash, and it should be approximately the equivalent of the amount of
So the decline.
Decline you see in that price of that mutual fund.
Right.
And, you know, the step right behind that is if you didn't reinvest, you can sell. You can realize that loss because it's only going to be based on the price.
Yep.
You got a loss that you can apply toward gains, and then you have the cash that you got that was the dividend.
So yeah, exactly.
Anyway, an interesting situation.
So when those happen, you're not actually losing money. The net asset value of that fund is actually decreasing, and you're getting more cash as a result that's essentially offsetting what would otherwise be a loss if that, that value were to go away.
Yeah, it is a bit of a confusing situation. So, DJ, is the market up or down this week?
We're going up.
There we go. I always like DJ.
I'm always.
He's a CWS. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah,
Jared.
Well, yeah, I do. And
in market?
Since I do have a fellow CWS, so I'm going to go with him today. I got to say it's going up, and you know that's rare for me.
That is pretty rare for you. Yes. And, of course, you know what's never rare for me because I'm a broken record.
It's been right for a while.
Yeah. It's more
all
often
is
than
life.
Not. That's,
all
it's
is life.
Easy. That's right.
That's right.
All right. Listening to Money Talks. We'll catch you next week.
All material presented is compiled from sources believed to be reliable and current, but accuracy cannot be guaranteed. The contents are intended for general information purposes only. Information provided should not be the sole basis in making any decisions and is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified professional, such as a tax consultant, insurance advisor, or attorney. Although this material is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with respect to the subject matter, it may not apply in all situations. This is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell any financial instruments. It is not our intention to state, indicate, or imply in any manner that current or past results are indicative of future profitability or expectations. Portfolio holdings discussed are subject to change. There is no guarantee that in the future these securities will be held in Hensler accounts. As with all investments, there are associated inherent risks. Please obtain and review all financial material carefully before investing. Hensler is not licensed to offer or sell insurance products. This overview is not to be construed as an offer to purchase any insurance products.